Oh, dang it. You're recording. Now I'm not going to say what I was going to say.
Oh, you should definitely say what you were going to say.
No, nope, I'll save that for after the recording.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, we're here just critiquing Luke's look this morning. So talking about the state of counties in California, how California is really at least three states. There's Southern California, there's the Bay Area, of which Sacramento is increasingly an extension, and there's all rural California. So the rural counties are all opening up, and it'll be very interesting because a lot of the suburbs of Sacramento are now in these rural counties. So things are going to be opening up out there. Are people from Sacramento going to travel there to buy in the stores? We don't really know. Although I had a conversation yesterday and a friend who his family is from Iowa and said that his parents' church had been open for 2 weeks and they usually have about 700 in worship and they've had about 100 for the last 2 weeks. So even if you open up, it doesn't mean that people will come.
But yeah, it's kind of interesting. It's just because, I don't know. I wonder with the whole thing with just what will happen. I think of that one Peugeot Joker video where he does the Heath Ledger Joker. Of just kind of walking through the symbolism of that. And I wonder if what this whole COVID thing will do with how we think of borders and which borders matter and which rules matter. And I don't know. It'll be interesting to see if it manifests that we get more local autonomy and borders and authority and structures. Cause that's the thing, you know, I mean, it's hard to treat California as if it's all the same thing,
yeah.
You know?
So. And Southern California has sort of become an epicenter, the Bay and Sacramento. Sacramento's numbers are very low. What's going on in Texas?
I think the numbers have started to go up a little bit, at least in the Dallas area since we've reopened. But I think that's to be expected. As you have more people getting together, I think the numbers are going to go up.
What does reopen look like in the Dallas area?
I have not been paying very close attention to it, but I think the guidelines are businesses are only supposed to operate at 25% capacity. I think that was the first stage. And we're still in the first stage. And then I think it's gatherings of no larger than 10, but that's as much as I know. I've perhaps it's my privilege, but I've been trying to stay away from news and just staying home. And whenever I get close to people out in the public, you know, I will go out and wear a mask. You know, we'll go out and grab some food from time to time, but it's always like takeout or definitely through the drive-thru. So. That's about as much as I know. There are people who are more informed that I'm sure could give you corrections to what I said, but that's how I understand it.
Churches open, closed?
Still closed. The people in my family that work in churches, I'll just leave it at that. they are going in and they are doing live broadcasts on Sunday of their worship service. They are socially distancing as they're doing their production, though, so nobody's getting closer than 6 feet to each other, which is an interesting dance. but yeah, I have found it to be much more, I like it better whenever I know that it's a live broadcast versus a canned recording, and then I sit down on a Sunday and it's just like, oh, so you guys were actually doing this on Thursday. And yeah, I'm sitting here with a live audience, but you know, it's like I'm watching Paul and John Vervaeke's premiere. It's not actually happening right now. The only interaction that can happen is here in the comments. And you know, I don't know. There's just something that seems more meaningful, or I like it better in some way whenever it's a live broadcast. I also understand that it's just not practical for some churches to be able to do that because they don't have the technologies in place, or it's just too foreign. You know, it's not something that they've practiced. And the one that I'm talking about, you know, they did it a little bit before all of this started, but it's just a lot of learning on the fly too. And they're fortunate where they have some volunteers that are in their congregation who are very skilled at this. So they could jump right in and knew exactly how to help the clerical staff, I don't know if that's the right way to say it, to help the pastors and the ministers along with things that, you know, they're not experts in so that they can do the things that they're trained to do.
I if we started doing, you know, if we got Rick and Pete and Nina in on Sunday mornings, if some of our other people heard that we were in the building on Sunday morning, they'd be hammering on the door to let us in, to let them in. And then it's like, do we lock these people out? I mean, that's part of the reality that
they're pounding on the door of the ark.
Well, that's right. You know, you guys are doing worship and I can't watch. I don't have broadband anyway. Why don't you just let me in? And
yeah.
Oh, just, I had a Zoom call yesterday with a bunch of the pastors from our CRCs in the region. And this question of, okay, if we reopen and there's social distancing, you know, are we going to kneecap 80-year-olds to keep them from hugging the other 80-year-olds? I'm not. Am I going to wrestle them to the floor and make them wear a mask? No. So, I mean, that's the kind of questions that we're dealing with in terms of the practicalities of what to come next. So what's going up in Minnesota? Minnesota.
Yeah, I don't know. Can we title this Kneecap 80-Year-Olds?
I'll look into it. Now, if we go that route and I end up, if we do a dual release of this again, Paul, and I end up making a thumbnail for it, I can't promise what kind of things might end up in those pictures.
Oh, man. Sometimes you said something in a recent video where I was just like, oh, man, that's so great. I'll have to remember. It'll come to me what the line was. Just, I didn't expect it. It was wonderful. Yeah, Minnesota. I think the shelter at home is supposed to stop Monday. Like you were saying, I don't know how that, I don't think it will really change anything because I think you still are going to have large gatherings and there's still some prohibitions on church meetings and things like that. And businesses are going to do kind of soft opens with limited amounts of people that can go in the stores, different things. Restaurants will still be closed. I don't know. And I'm not, you know, speaking Jeff's privilege, I'm also not one to ask because I don't follow any of that. Like if someone, unless you mention it or like Rogan maybe mentions it or the Discord is talking about it, I don't know what's going on besides what I can see in my neighborhood or what my neighbors talk about. And that just usually devolves into wearing masks and conservatives denying that COVID exists and how terrible Trump is. So I don't
know. Conservatives are complaining about Trump?
No. I mean, I live in Minneapolis proper. There's a few conservatives here. You could tell they usually have like they're driving pickups covered in Trump stickers. but then everyone else is very. I saw some girl on a run that said like, oh man, I almost stopped and talked to her because my low politeness. But it said like voting is my superpower, and I just wanted to be like. Oh man, that's like, if you could just write a little axiom that I could just be like, this is the archetype of kind of what's wrong with the world. There it is. So, outside of that, I don't know. There's not, it's an interesting world. It doesn't look that much different to me, except that I'm now like a full-time IT person for my children. Except for right now, they're supposed to be. So my wife is working and they're here. So we'll see how good they behave during this.
Well, we didn't gather today to talk about COVID. I'm not exactly sure what we're talking about, so I'll let you guys start.
Well, I can't remember what the impetus was. I was listening to something that you said, and I wanted to talk about propositional truth, because I still think this is a of the Verveke's four P's have become jargon in this little corner. And I talk about these things. We listen to you, and I talk about these things with Jeff and some of the other people, and it comes up in the Discord. And I was saying something. I sent a big couple long audios to Jeff and some other people, and I was like, I still don't feel like I'm being clear on this, or people understand what I was saying. And then Jeff responded with, and this was very my Enneagram 4, was just overwhelmed with affection for Jeff, because Jeff responded, and he's like, I think this is what you're saying. And I was just like, yes, yes, that's what I'm saying. Thank God. Thank the Lord. So Jeff is a little bit of my, I brought Jeff in because I think.
He translates your tongues.
Yeah, he can translate my tongues. And
I should comment that in last Friday's Discord chat, the first question out of the box was about speaking in tongues. And was it Luke that you said that Jeff is your tongue strand? Luke is the one who speaks in tongues and Jeff does the interpretation. Was it this pair? Yeah. Was there another pair that claimed that?
I think I said that. I think, yeah. I said a little bit like how Luke talks and I'll interpret what he says.
Yeah, it's it works well that way, though, because the Cliff Notes version, I think, and what Jeff had said of what really struck him is the way that I had framed it. There's a few different I think supporting ways to think about it that I think help, but it's essentially the idea that propositional knowledge is, I would put almost in a separate category, and maybe with perspectival, in that I think propositional knowledge is potential knowledge. And I wouldn't put it on the same level as participatory or procedural, because those are by necessity enacted. Those are by necessity act as if knowledge, and propositional is not. And I think that's really, really important, because I think what is happening in the West with, not only in religious communities, not only in explicitly religious communities, but also irreligious communities, also social justice warriors. The whole phenomenon of identitarianism, I think, comes out of a misunderstanding and a misuse of what propositions and propositional knowledge is. So,
you have an interpretation, Jeff?
Well, actually, what I wanted to do first was just see if, Paul, you could give like a very quick summary of what propositional knowledge is in the way that Verveke frames it.
Well, I was listening. Oh, what talk was Verveke doing? Oh, he in his, I someone had noted on Twitter, which was very interesting, a little scary, had noted, Paul, you haven't listened to the Verveke McGilchrist talk on Rebel Wisdom yet. And I thought, no, I hadn't. And so I started listening to it. And right at the beginning, about, you know, 4 or 5 minutes into that conversation, John gives a nice summary articulation of his four P's. A part of the challenge with John in his Awakening from the Meaning Crisis series is that it's so expansive that sometimes you really want the thumbnail versions of this. So proposition, I think propositional truth is, and has become in this conversation, sort of the credo belief level, in some cases, scapegoat or even whipping boy of Christendom's confessional moments, that and it makes perfect sense if you think about modernity and then postmodernity. What we're skeptical of and therefore attacking are the propositional statements of Christendom that Christianity has used, in fact, to create identity and community. So the Apostles' Creed, So the one of the churches that we met in Tucson, the village, the church of my friend Rod, they're not technically a Christian Reformed church. They're an independent church, and their only credo is the Apostles' Creed, and that gives them kind of a simple, fairly simplistic. It doesn't have all the kinds of things you'll find in, let's say, especially the canons of Dort. So it's, I believe this, I believe that, I believe this, I believe that. Now, it's tempting to look at these propositions as very modernistic, and there's a real relationship between propositional knowledge and modernism. But obviously, these things took on a tremendous amount of power and life very early on. The Apostles' Creed isn't in the Bible, but we don't actually know when it first arose. We just know it arose very, very early. And this kind of propositional approach to Christianity came about very early. In fact, even in the period of the apostles in Scripture, with something as Jesus is Lord. Because there's a credo propositional statement, which is obviously riffing on Caesar is Lord. And so propositional truth and propositional knowledge has, and that formulation of knowledge has been around a very long time. What's interesting in the Verveke McGilchrist conversation, because that conversation is very interesting on this subject, because McGilchrist's whole project asserts that this, the propositional knowledge is really a very left-brained thing. That the left brain can't see what the right brain can see, but the right brain can't say what the left brain can say. And so propositional knowledge is a very left-brained thing, and McGilchrist's complaint is that this left-brainism has sort of taken over the world, and that's not exactly good for us. So I probably completely failed Luke's or Jeff's question, which is a little summary. Propositional stuff is Jesus is Lord. I believe in God the Father. Donald Trump is a Republican. Joe Biden is a Roman Catholic. You know, things like this.
It's an abstracted truth.
Yes. And it's propositional. And Verveke talks about this. Well, it wasn't actually Verveke. It was someone in the Discord server who said, or it might have been, I think it was Mary that said, it's sort of third person-ish. It's out here apart from us. And that's what separates it from the procedural, which is things that we do, the perspectival, which is sort of the I and the thou, and the participatory, which is sort of the we. In that sense, it's the third person of. It's not first person. It's not second person. That's, that's really relational. It's the third person. It's the thing that's out there. And of course, modernism, especially trying to approximate this monarchical vision, attempts to say, and Sam Harris and that approach to knowledge basically says that's the only true knowledge we have is propositional knowledge. None of the other kinds of knowledge really matters.
Go ahead. And in an objectivist way, they deny the perspectival part of it.
Yes, yes.
And so, like, the McGilchrist thing is huge, I think, because that's one of, if I had three supporting buttresses for trying to explain what I mean about propositional as potential and really putting it in a different category, because that's where this goes off the rails, I think. Most people just sit here and have dialogue staying almost exclusively in the arena of the propositional, and they think that's the whole arena. And that's and then you get into like excluding people, deplatforming people, pushing people out of the bound. You bind and blind around mere propositions, and that is you've completely misunderstood the whole ballgame. Because that's the lopsided left brain that McGilchrist has talked about. He's one of the pieces that I would bring in. And then I have So then just to lay out my other two pieces, and then we can go into them in whatever depth you want, would be, I think one of the other ones is, one of the things that really struck me was J.P. Is it Marceau? Is that how you say his name? In his conversation with Peugeot, he talked about, they talked about the violence and the grace of eating food and the give and take of that whole phenomenon of when you eat food, you chew it up, it goes down in your stomach. And you, but like, in order to have true nourishment, in order for the food to do what it's supposed to, in order for the food to act as if what food is for you, not only do you have to chew it, not only do you have to put it in your hand, put it in your mouth, chew it up, swallow it down, you have to fully digest it so that it becomes part of you. We behave in such a world, I call that Eucharistic knowledge. Knowledge needs to, the proposition can't just be something that you use in your hand. It can't just be something that you use as a label and throw out there, like, because that's just potential. It's meaningless until you do it. So that's one of the other pieces I would bring in. And then, and I don't know, these are too big. The other one is that I think I can explain, at least from my perspective, or at least throw out a thesis of how I think the lopsided left brain phenomenon happened and how propositional objectivist knowledge through modernity, through the evolution of consciousness in kind of a Barfieldian way. I think I can explain how that happened through the development of the self and the inner life and all that kind of stuff. If you want to go down that route too.
I just wanted to throw in here. I mean, I think one of the things that led to Luke wanting to have this conversation with you, Paul, and wanting to pull me into it was the fact that, you know, after he had shared some ideas, I just gave him a response back of what in there kind of resonated with me. And I think this first part that I'm about to talk about ties together. I'm kind of just recounting the little audio message that I left for you, Luke, but it started off with me referencing a conversation that John Verbeke posted on his channel between him and Tyler from the Discord.
Oh, yep. Yep.
You got a chance to watch that, Paul.
I did watch that. That was a good conversation.
In that conversation, they talked about conversations between people and how there's some kind of quality in particular to the types of conversations that we've been having on the Discord and we've been having on this corner of this corner of this corner of the internet. And how people can be involved in the conversation as long as they're trying to keep the conversation going. And I think they said this was in like a Socratic type way, but just trying to keep the conversation going. And that the point of it was not to try to win. You're not trying to win the conversation. You're not even necessarily trying to convince the other person that the proposition that you're making is true and to get them to agree with that proposition. But rather, the thing that they said that they were noticing was the two people, just by virtue of being involved in a conversation that you want to keep going, gets you to a place that you could not have gotten on your own. It may be you coming to the conclusion that the propositions that your interlocutor was making ends up being something that you agree with. It may be that you were totally unconvinced and you never are convinced of those propositions. But you had some other kind of revelation that came as a result of having that conversation. You may have seen it as connected. It may have been completely unrelated, but the point being that I really enjoyed from their conversation is I have had those experiences where you reach a place you feel like, no, there's no way I could have gotten here without this other person. And wow, I didn't even realize that I could have gotten to this place as a result of that conversation, but somehow I did. And so the other thing that I talked to Luke about as far as what stood out to me that he has said over and over and over again, but it just, I don't know, it never stuck in my mind until I heard it probably the 50th time. And so maybe people will appreciate this, maybe not, but I encourage Luke that because of my experience, yes, just keep saying the same things over again and people may eventually hear
it. Take that, Andreas.
But his point that the propositional is potential. It is an abstraction. It's almost a theorization of what, here's what I will do when faced with this situation because I know what I propositionally believe about it, right? And I've had too many experiences in my life where I thought I knew what I was going to do if I ever faced generic situation. And then when it gets dropped on me, when I didn't recognize, oh my gosh, I am just now being thrown into this situation, particularly that I had a very general conception of what I was going to do and who I was and how I was going to embody those beliefs. And I did something completely different. And so what I got out of this whole thinking about what Luke was proposing is, you know, we don't really know what's real until trials test and reveal. And that was accidentally a rhyme, but I somehow came up with it.
It's good though. It's good.
Yeah. We don't know what's real about ourselves. And these conversations that we're having, I think they have to be, I think the primary purpose of these conversations that we have to be about building relationships between the participants, or else for the most part, they're not really producing any fruit.
They won't work, because it'll just, if you're not really, you ultimately won't be able to, you actually won't be able to follow JP's, Jordan Peterson's, JBP's rule number 9, and assuming the person you're talking to may know something you don't, or like Eric Weinstein's island rules that I like to bring up very often. You won't be able to do those things if you live in this, if you live in the lopsided left brain, where you live in this very dualistic right and wrong, and you equate that to your map. You equate that to your left brain understanding, your model, and all models are false, some are useful. You'll never actually be able to engage that person in a good faith conversation, because you will be subconsciously in a mode of winning all the time, because you're fighting for some kind of objectivist truth that you think that you see, rather than the way that I like to describe it. And this is why I say this is an act as if conversational Trinitarianism, because you have an I and you have a thou and you have a bridge. Like, that's what I think the dialogos and what they were talking about is that you have some unknown, unrepresented, unapproachable truth, like the religio, as Jordan Peterson out here, that like you just, that you tap into, and you do that, and you, and through the logos, through this interaction between the two, you tap into that spirit in a way that you can't do in your isolated bubble. You know?
That was all really good. I'm just really glad we got it recorded. from both of you. Yeah, let's and we're not going to do knee-copping granny. We're going to do, you know, we don't know what's real until trials and tests reveal. That's a good title.
It's a pastor.
it preaches. No, this is all really, really good, and it pulls just a lot of things together. It is interesting to me, the first, second, and third person. So this thing sort of, I mean, so Luke brought in the Trinitarian idea. You know, Jeff, I think, really brought in the you know, the other P's, fleshed it out, you know, with your little story about we our imagination. Well, I think it's helpful to go way back to Plato, perhaps, and understand why he ironically had such fear and trepidation about the written word. That, in a sense, the written word is a very third person thing. And part of the reason, you know, so I was listening to the McGilchrist Verveke conversation and thinking about the fact that part of the reason we tend to be so lopsided in this perspective is because we have discovered the power of the propositional, and I think the reproducibility of the propositional. So this morning I was mentioning to Luke that I'm starting to get now a routine for my new pandemic reality. And usually the first movement of the day, the early morning, before I start talking to people or listening to anything, is usually sermon work or video PowerPoint work. And so I was working on my sermon for Sunday, and I'm using the, it was posted on the Discord, the like stories of old, the last two videos where he's saying stories are not reality and heroes, you know, are not what you think they are. And so in my sermon on 1 Peter 3, really 2 and 3, I sort of deconstruct those two videos, and the roots of, you know, what was so evident to me, and I'll probably do a video about this next week, maybe my Monday video will be about this. The, when you watch those two videos and you understand Christianity, you know why the developmental path that he says, that he shows basically ends up why it does. It's because of Christianity. Because Christianity exemplified, as Jordan Peterson noted, the hero's journey. And as C.S. Lewis and Tolkien noted, here you have the myth becoming life, the myth becoming flesh. And then that myth becoming flesh then gets into every man. So the hapless disciples themselves can become the heroes of the book of Acts and the heroes of the New Testament, let's say. And then women and people of other, you know, races, they then become heroes in the story. And so what we see is that the propositions, Caesar is Lord, Jesus is Lord, these things are very easy for us to do. And they're also very, they can be universalized fairly quickly, and they can, because they can be appropriated so well. But what, in a sense, we do with film and with story and with other things is that we take the proposition and we try to feed the other layers with it. And I think that's exactly what Jeff just noted, that this vision he had in his mind, you know, the other P's were certainly lurking in there, but it was sort of propositional. But once it actually becomes procedural and in real life participatory, well, that the falsely theoretical of the propositional has to give way. But then new propositions, because, you know, we don't know what is real until trials and tests reveal. There's a propositional line right there.
Yep.
And so there's always this dynamic between the four P's. And that's why, you know, I hear a lot of complaining and critiquing and criticizing the propositional. But it's why I keep bringing back into the conversation, but we're not going to get rid of it, just like we're not going to get rid of the third person in the English language. And what's so interesting, to bring this back into Jordan Peterson land, is that it's the third person pronouns that sparked the fight around C16. People, and it's sort of the third person, it's the interaction between the third person pronouns and the first and second person world. How dare you mislabel me with that third person pronoun? But they haven't, you know, even though people are using they in the singular, I've heard no one demand that they use, I've seen no one start using the we for themselves or the us. Well, the us, you know, very quickly joins with the second person, because you is sort of partly third person already, as opposed to us. So, you know, it's very interesting how even something as simple as first, second, third person in our language. Now, what's interesting is now you can map this onto dimensions. Now, then you look at, say, fourth dimension, which is, of course, time. Then you pull that into the mix, and it gets really interesting and fun. So I don't know if I've made anything clear or just rambled on you poor hapless souls who asked for this.
Thinking about the...
But let me just finish by saying, I really like your ideas, third person and propositional as potential. I think there's a lot of really cool potential in that observation.
Well, my concern is that I essentially think, so what identitarianism is, and then and then the phenomenon of just excluding and dividing and having tribal warfare around labels is to stop at the propositional level. It's not necessarily about your behavior or what you do. It's just like, and I mean, there's many, many illustrations about that. It could be like, it doesn't matter if you love, it's just like, and this what's what leads into people not being open to saying what they really think, because that's a very common occurrence everywhere. I mean, in this community, it's a common occurrence. It's a common occurrence in political circles, is people don't want to say they said something. Because like, even if I said to my neighbors, some of my neighbors, like something as seemingly reasonable as like, I don't think Trump is the Antichrist, you know, like that could just like shut down a wall. Like I could just be dead to them. But like, that's the problem. Like shutting things down at that kind of propositional level and not entering into the Eucharistic knowledge, the testing and the trials of like, what do I mean by that? Long form conversation. Like, don't Kathy Newman me, essentially, is what I'm trying to say. But I think that's what happens around the ideas of propositions. That's what happens with like Sam and Unitarians. It's just like, Sam is a Unitarian. Boom, door closed.
Ounce.
I will not talk to you. You know, you're a heretic. Boom.
Well, the representations, you know, we're associating a lot of meaning, a lot of preconceptions with the Trump is not the Antichrist. Sam is a Unitarian. Part of that is, what are the worst things that I can think of that this person probably means by that? That just comes rushing to our minds. And another dynamic of that, I think, is we go into quarantine mode. It's like, well, I'm not going to get infected by this. You know, what if I start letting Sam talk to me and I start turning into a Unitarian?
Yeah, it's the disgust impulse that we talked about with like hate, which is really a conservative impulse, right? It's the keep the outside out. And this is something Jeff and I talked about, and Jeff was bringing up, is that the Jordan Peterson descriptions of like the hero and what's outside the wall. And this feeds both points, because Paul, what you're saying is propositions are good. Like the walls are good. There's a lot of things out there that will kill you. Like it's a bad thing, but there's also the thing out there that you will bring in that will revivify the city. But like when you treat propositions though as just hard walls and not semi-permeable membranes, like a cell, the cell dies. And so you can't treat propositions that way. And I guess that's my argument, because this is what people often come back to me and retort, is just like, you don't like propositions. There, you just used a proposition. You're busted, you know? And it's like, no, it's not what I'm talking about. Or there's like, Eastern Orthodox have propositions. Sure, yeah, got it. I understand. But so like they are, they're fine. You have to treat them for what they are. And you can't ever, I think, get confused that, and this is why I love McGilchrist in the conversation so much, the map is not the territory. And I think this is the problem, is that I just don't, this is where it becomes like where I'll spiritualize it and get like really, this is why I talk about things like egoic intellect and principalities, is that this is a phenomenon that I've experienced a lot. There are a lot of people there's a number of people that I've talked to who I think begin to understand what I'm saying with all this propositionally, but it doesn't stop them from acting in a way that's still along the lines of what I'm saying. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So like they'll understand propositionally the danger of treating propositions that way, but it doesn't change their behavior at the procedural and the participatory level. This is why I think the Bible talks so much about like with testing and fruit and, you know, and the whole book of James, you know, the James Paul split. You know, you say you have faith by this, I'll show you my faith by what I do. And I think what's so hard about that, because this gets into the evolution of consciousness stuff, is that, and N.T. Wright has really pithy quotes about this, like, which I can't remember off the top of my head because they're too good, but like, I think we very often do anachronistically read the Bible with modern lenses. And, but N.T. Wright says something like, we need to stop asking 15th century questions with 21st century lenses and start asking 21st century questions with, I don't know, something like that.
Probably first century lenses. I mean,
yeah,
because he's,
or trying
in many
to.
Ways primarily a historian.
Yeah.
I'm gonna go back to the first, second, and third person in speech and make the observation of one thing I learned in dealing with interpersonal conflict, that if a relationship has gotten so bruised and therefore tender, because when you get a really bad bruise or a really bad burn, the thing is, it's enormously tender. You can almost not do anything. One of the things I very quickly learned was second and third person language in the middle of trying to have a dialogue with a person with whom you are having significant conflict. The second and third persons are almost places you can't go. Anytime you say you in a conflict, you're imposing your reality on me. Anytime you say even something third person, it's risky, because you, the person with whom I'm having conflict, is now in a sense distilling reality propositionally, and about the only thing you have left is the first person. I this, I that, and don't sneak second and third person into the first. I feel that, you know, so just read all kinds of conflict and marriage books, and you know, you'll get tons of this stuff. Yet at the same time, there's, in terms of part of growing up and being able to participate in robust, meaningful, productive dialogue is having to properly manage the third person, which means that someone puts up a third person statement and a propositional statement, and okay, so there it is. Let's not get reactive about it either way, either by just absorbing it or by being allergic to it. Just let it live there in the third person. Don't be afraid of it. Don't bow down and worship it. Just let it be what it is. And if you can get to that point, then you can deal with, you know, Trump is not the Antichrist, or Sam is a Unitarian, and we don't have to freak the heck out because we've had 1,500 years of cultural formation that you know, Servetus comes to mind. So I think it's really helpful, but at the same time, I mean, there's equal and opposite reactions, which is to say, well, we are going to avoid the third person. Okay. You can't build community without the propositional. And I think the reason that propositional statements have become so ubiquitous in church history is because they're so powerful in affording community. Now I think as we're rightly noting, they can be deeply problematic, and Sam's participation, and in fact, even leadership. I mean, when Sam took the Discord off for Lent, You know, you could feel some of the energy, you know, leave the community because all of the stuff that Sam brings in wasn't there. And well, Sam's a heretic. Yeah, the Discord isn't a church either. And the higher resolution we go into Sam's Unitarianism, the more we, you know, that's why I loved his conversation with Brett Sockold, is that just like we were talking about with these conversations, it wasn't about winning between them, but I think both Sam and Brett came away from that conversation with more than they came into it. They felt blessed by the conversation. And I, who just simply overheard, had the same experience. And, you know, ideally when the thing that we're doing right now, in fact, that we've sort of discovered, ideally when it works, whatever that means for us, is when that happens. And I think what we're trying to do with this analysis of the four P's and the strengths and limitations of each of the P's is, you know, upping the resolution on, okay, how can we not only theoretically derive rules, that's very propositional, rules about how to have better dialogues, but we are practicing it. Because just like Luke said, or just like Jeff said, we have all these, you know, rules about, you know, how to succeed, rules for success. I have all these rules, which are propositional. Those rules mean nothing until you try them. And there's these other aspects of knowledge, the procedural, the participatory, the perspectival, that won't get engaged until I actually have an encounter with the proposition and all four P's come together, which is, you know, far closer to a better model of life. And again, I haven't talked about this potential idea because I, you know, but I think that's really key in that. And I think it's in that movement that the propositional is potential because, you know, Jeff imagines himself into the future. There's the potential. But it isn't until the other three P's are enjoined with that fourth propositional P, that third person thing, that suddenly, well, then it happens. And, well, expectations perhaps aren't realized, but new things, unexpected, are discovered and appreciated and then get built into the ongoing movement into more of the propositional. So I think in your observation, Luke, on the propositional being potential, there's always something eschatological about the propositional. Because again, it's sort of timeless in the monarchical vision. And so when we say Jesus is Lord, that's an eschatological statement because we look around and we say, well, that lordship is in tension with the age of decay right now. And what we're leaning into the future potential for is Jesus, is Christ being all in all. And so I think that's perhaps some of the reason why the propositional is potential, because it is third person, it is away from us. I don't know, that's a whole lot right there.
Well, so a couple things that I want to add in that I was thinking of in this is there's a Peugeot clip, and I can't remember what the title of it is. I'll find it and tell you guys, but it's of his conversation with Father Stephen Freeman, and it's talking about it's something about, like, and Father Freeman said this, which I think is a great quote, and you can find the same truth in other places, like Dostoevsky says this too, but nobody ever knows anything in general. They only ever know anything in particular. And Jeff actually said that, like, you used a different, like, and when you were saying, you said like this generic thing, but you didn't know it until it was tested, until it became particular, till it manifested. And what's interesting, the kind of epiphany as you were talking, I was thinking about the general in particular. You don't know God. You can't know God. You only ever know the particular, the manifestation, which is the word. That's all you ever know. And then what mediates between those two things is the spirit. And that's the transcendent dance piece between all of this. And I think this is why I think all this conversation, I say this a lot, and Sam and I at some point will have a conversation about this, but why I just see Trinity stuff everywhere. And ever since I started talking to Sam, I was just like, oh, this isn't just like abstracted stuff that doesn't matter. Like, this is fundamental to the nature of everything. It isn't just like these ideas that these people decided to come up with to map onto something. They were exegeting what is. And they just saw that because everything is reflective of God, which that makes sense. I mean, no matter how you want to even define God, define it on a Jordan Peterson lens, you know, everything is reflective of that. And then it's fractally works out from that. And so, and that's what I've just been seeing more and more, that in dialogue, that's why I say the short version of that is like, in dialogue, we need to act as if in a Trinitarian way. Because if you don't, you'll either act, this is why I like the frames that I bring up all the time, like monism, dualism, and Trinitarianism, which is another option. Like, monism is meaninglessness. Everything's illusory. There is no truth. Truth is untruth. It's all the same thing. Doesn't matter. I don't even really exist. Like, this is just illusion. And eventually it'll all be, no matter what you are, even if you're a materialist, it came from a big bang of nothing. And eventually it will collapse back into nothing. And this is all just like the C.S. Lewis bottle of fizz just going off. There's no meaning. Or you can fall into a dualism, which is a lopsided left brain, I would say, right and wrong, black and white. I'm on team objective, good fact team, which you have the Sam Harris types, which are like, this is just scientific fact. Or you have the Ben Shapiro types, facts don't care about your feelings. Like, these are just facts. It's just the way it is, you know, which is where a lot of the modern discourse is around. You have the religious types too, which is just like, this is just the Bible. This is just facts.
Right. It's the modernist apologetic approach.
Right. But I would say all of those are acting unchristianly.
Anytime you untrinitarianly.
Same thing to me.
But that's the aspect. That's a little higher definition. That's the aspect of Christian that you're saying it fails.
Yeah. Which is the openness to, and this is why it's not a, I think this is why it's hard for people to wrap their heads around, is it's not denying hierarchy. It's not denying better or worse. It's not denying, and this is why people don't like have a hard time with Jordan Peterson. It's not denying paths and truth and orientations. It's not denying that, but it's saying you don't see it objectively because you can't. And that's the iconic vision. Everything is a model. If you don't, like Verbeke said this in his talk, he was saying you see it as an image instead of a portal. But I think it's actually, I would say that, I think an icon is an image and a portal.
Right.
It's both.
Right.
So I don't know. That was a lot. I don't know how that relates to what you were saying. And the other piece with all this that's tough is that I think we don't, The Barfield evolution of consciousness stuff is really important because, and there's a Father John Baer clip where he's talking about, is God a person, where he brings this up just in passing, and it's true, but he says it really depends on what you mean. Like the whole idea of person developed in Trinitarian theology around the fourth century. And even if you look from like the time of Jesus to the time of now, what we think of as a person isn't just clear for how like a first century person would have thought about themselves. The way that they've conceived of themselves and their own person, their identity is very different. The inner self, the self-identifying, all of that stuff is, if you think first century people were thinking that way when they were writing the New Testament, they weren't. That developed all later.
I get the impression that they also have this conception that they are actually carrying, they're carrying their ancestors with them.
Yes.
In their day-to-day is the wrong way of saying it, but just like, I don't know, some of the things I run across in the Old Testament, just seem to talk about how, you know, they felt like they were a part of Jacob. They felt like they were a part of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They felt like they were with them. They were still those what we would call individual persons was their identity, was this broader, bigger thing. And I feel like in our current age and current culture, we're almost like completely divorced from it. Any conception that I notice that we have of being like our ancestors is, oh, I never thought I was going to turn into my dad. And it's something we want to avoid. You know, it seems like more often than not, people are saying, oh, I'm turning into my mother, you know? versus like a conception of, well, no, I'm not turning into my mother. I am a part of my mother, and my mother's a part of me, and that's a way of being. And that's just, it's like the water that I'm swimming in. I wouldn't even know what you're talking about when you're saying, oh, I'm becoming my mother. What do you mean?
Well, and this gets into, so Jeff and I talked about this, Paul, I'd love your thoughts on it. This gets into, like, I don't think we throw, so I can crap on the West a lot and the egoic intellect and the negative side of this whole development, which I think was an error.
And annoy Carl while you're doing it.
Right. Right. Yeah. I honestly don't know how to not annoy Carl.
I will agree with that. I mean, one of the only things you say that he'll agree with.
Yeah. Well, that's because I'm an ass brain. I mean, there's just no good around it. But I think about it really in like a spiral dynamics way, or what I was saying to Jeff is that in the space trilogy, in the end of Paralandra, Ransom, Lewis, well, it's not really Lewis. Lewis is in the trilogy. Ransom is this character who has this vision when he sees like the glorified Eldila and king and queen of Paralandra. And he has this like vision of all these colors interweaving and these things happen and discordant notes, and somebody make, it reminded me of the Song of the Anuer in the Silmarillion, in the beginning of Tolkien's Silmarillion, Melkor came in a discordant note, but then Iluvatar rewove it into something more glorious.
Yes.
I think that's what's happening in a very Barfield original, because what Jeff was describing, I think, is original participation. We are the seed of our ancestors, we're our ancestors, we're all one. Our identity is in our, the seed and the genetic and the people. What happened, I think, with the development of the self, which came from Christianity and then went just haywire in modernity and the Enlightenment, was every man became an island, and it was an island of their abstractions in their mind, and it was completely disconnected from the whole. I think what is going to happen through Protestantism, the Enlightenment, all these things is, this is what I was saying to Jeff. My hope, my prayer is that in a reintegration of the divorced selves, you will have a reunion of the whole, but in a enlightened, for lack of a better term, an enlightened, interpersonal way. So it will be the one among the many. It will be difference, but yet unity. I think this is the vision of the New Testament. And so like the way that I illustrated it, because I think this, the fractal nature of the universe is that like a family is a little microcosm of everything. It's representative of everything. So like with my kids, when they're little kids, they're really part of me. They're really dependent on me. They're actually in me and my wife in a way. And then they come out and they're separate, but they're not really separate. They're really dependent on me. They need you for everything. They don't even really have a sense of identity, but then as they grow and mature, and they need rules and structures and models, they have to have that. But then as they grow, they have to come into their own, and they have to learn to fly, and they have to become separate. And maybe that might be painful and weird for a while, but if they become separate and they're different and they come back and you stay a whole cohesive whole, but with that individuality and that difference, that's a more beautiful thing in kind of a Cimmerillian Lewis way. And it's almost like a, oh, there's another place I was going to go with that, but then I lost it.
You're stacking up how many places I have to backtrack over what you've said. So sorry, we were talking, I might not hit them all.
When we talked about this earlier, Luke, we were talking about how it kind of was analogous to a tribal mentality versus, I can't remember what we were juxtaposing that to, but we were essentially talking about how the tribal mentality is just a way of seeing the world where everything outside of the tribe is bad and it will cause harm. And that's very important to keeping a group alive. And then that the hyper individuality becomes the person that leaves the tribe and goes out there and, you know, the Jordan Peterson way goes out and slays the dragon and finds the gold and brings the gold back. And I think to connect that to what you were saying is in the spiral dynamic sense of, you know, this is a bad thing if you break from the tribe and you do things that the tribe says is wrong. And so that's like way over here. But as you're spinning out, you bring the good that's back in from that individualism, that hyper individualism that you talked about that we
do,
and that will the good things that were imbued inside of that hyper individualism will swing back around and come in and be integrated with the tribal mindset or the way of the consciousness way of viewing what people are versus how they're viewed now in a kind of an individualistic frame. One other conception that I remember Lewis talking about as far as how ancients viewed humanity, or maybe how God views humanity is what he was saying, is more instead of seeing humanity as these individual cells, God's view of humanity is more like a tree.
Yeah.
Well, and Lewis's essay on equality gets into that. And he notes the difference between a bag of widgets, which is modernity's view of, you know, members at Costco are all the same. They pay their amount. And in fact, anti-racism in modernity rightly says shouldn't matter if you're white or black or Asian or Hispanic or male or female. If you're a member in Costco, you're the same. But membership in the church, a la the Apostle Paul, is very different because you have the hand and the eye and the nose and the feet. And the eye says to the hand, you know, I have no part of you. And it's like, because you're not like me. No, because it's good that the hand isn't like the eye because you've already got an eye and you need a hand. So it gets into that. But you guys had left me so much. I want to go back through now. And that's why I keep notes. Yes, the tribal thing. And again, and you'll see this when the rough draft comes out on Saturday, because this gets into the question of the hero's journey. Because the hero's journey is the way that tribalism is managed properly, because the tribe rightly says, you know, keep the things out because they're dangerous. The hero says, I'll risk the danger for the potential. So I'll leave the tribe, go to the underworld, meet the mentor, find the girl, come back to the tribe transformed, and therefore transform the tribe. And it begins a process by which, you know, tribes both maintain their identity as tribes, but yet transcend the limitations of their identity and evolve into new tribes. And that then, you know, your family is microcosm of everything is very interesting, because I remember a conversation about abortion, because of course the Supreme Court in Roe versus Wade used viability as an argument for abortion. Someone comes along and says, now wait a minute, let's use a 1 month old baby. Is that baby viable? And this gets very interesting when you look at you know, studies of adoption, where, you know, maybe the best case scenario where this adopted child is relinquished to another family of origin. And over the last number of years, psychologists looking at that said, well, there's been a wound in the separation of the mother, you know, the separation from the mother to the child. There's been a wound there that consciously the adopted child has no conscious awareness of that wound, but that wound is built in. And so you very much have the shalomic whole of the family, which is wounded and torn apart. Now backtracking through what you had talked about, Luke, because I made notes, one of the things that modern Protestant confessionalism reduced people to were bags of confessions.
Yep.
So to be a member of a church, in a sense, you open up your confessional, propositional, credo list and say, these are the things I believe. Okay, now you can be a member of the church. In the Christian Reformed Church, as a youth, you would study the Heidelberg Catechism. Say, I believe to the propositions of the Heidelberg Catechism. Go to the church council, get quizzed on these propositions, and then voila, you are now a member of the church. Now, there's a lot of good that I can be said of that we especially know since that form has sort of been passed away, because it was sort of replaced with a much more evangelical form that on one hand had the propositions, but on the other hand, our heart had to be strangely warmed and we had to give some experiential evidence for a transformed life. And you see the influence of Methodism, you know, coming on top of the confessional Protestantism. And if you look at church history, you can see, you know, these same things being worked on. And so then you have people who, and you can find it now in the question of same-sex marriage in the church. Okay, so these people have some of these propositions, or Sam, some of these propositions are not in order. Sam won't say, I believe in the Trinity, but Sam plays the guitar and can lead with worship music and knows a lot more about, you know, patristic theology than your average, and history than your average pastor, because of his Trinitarian deficiencies. And I think that's right. And then you get into that, you know, where you started with the, well, not even where you started, because you started a long ways up, but Perelanda and the Silmarillion and original participation, where, you know, Iluvatar takes, you know, here's this discordant strain that comes through into the song and Iluvatar has to find a way. Now this will get into a lot of patristic conversations that yield eventually the infralapsarian versus supralapsarian controversies of the Protestant confessional world, because how are we to think about the relationship between God's intentionality and the discordant Melchor strain that comes into the song? And that's the whole question of the fall. And you can see this manifest in interesting conversations, especially between Orthodox, who tend to preserve, you know, some of these very ancient patristic ideas, and modern Protestants. And so in that sense, when the Orthodox come to America, which is deeply Protestant, I mean, remember that North America was founded by Protestant rebels who, there was no place in Europe, so the pilgrims first go to the Netherlands, which is more tolerant than England, but just doesn't feel like home, and then they make the eschatological move out into, you know, the wilderness of New England to found that city on a hill. And of course, those themes get poured into the American mythos and the American story, which in many ways continues to be deconstructed and worked over now. So yeah, you guys hit on a lot of stuff there, and it was really good. I don't know if And I, yeah, how do you, and I guess the last comment I made after Jeff talked about the tribes was, you know, again, it's how to get the both and I think you're right that you see that in Revelation with, in the visions of Revelation 5 and Revelation 7, where you have these, you know, these throngs of people made up of people from every tribe and every nation, but they're singing something terribly propositional, which is, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain." And there's tons of propositions built into "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain." So, and you know, you can get very Girardian at that point, in terms of the Lamb who was slain, the scapegoat, and how does this slain Lamb then bring peace, as Paul says, between the this barrier of hostility between Jews and Gentiles, and off we go in that.
Well, this, do you have any thoughts, Jeff? I was just going to maybe going to take it on a slight tangent, but what you just said just made me think of that, is that I think another piece that you could think about with the whole propositional thing and "Worthy is the Lamb" at the end of Revelation is,
that's in the middle.
The end of the Bible.
In "Behold, Revelation. I make all things new." That's at the end.
Yeah. It's one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot as I describe these things. This is what Sherry tells me.
And the lake of fire. Let's not forget that.
The lake of fire. Yeah. Well, so we could talk about that too.
Trigger the Discord.
Yeah. Are we having a third hell conversation? Is that what?
We can do that.
Let's not keep going. Sorry.
The, shut up. One of the things is because Sherry is becoming kind of the Discord patristic scholar because she just reads everything and stays awake all night. But as I describe these things, because she's one of the other people that I'll just send my sprawling audio thoughts to things, and then she responds, and she told me recently that she's like, she thinks what I'm describing with my egoic intellect and some of these things is essentially what Maximus the Confessor called the gnomic will. And the gnomic will, from what I understand of it, I mean, I haven't done a ton of reading on it, but Wikipedia has a just kind of a cliff note summary, is, but it's interesting because this is something I've thought about a lot, is the analytical, it's kind of the mind that analyzes, that chooses between options, that like says, it's essentially almost like a libertarian, it's like how you could understand libertarian freedom in a way, is just like this option or this option. And Maximus was essentially, what he was saying is that, and this is Trinitarian theology again, is that Jesus was of such a kind and of one essence with the Father and undivided in such a way that he didn't have a gnomic will. A gnomic will is the kind of thing that we have in the fall where we sit here and we do. Another way that I would describe it in biblical language is double-mindedness. We are of two minds, where Paul in like Romans 7, even like, oh wretched man that I am, I want to do this, but then I end up doing this. Or Jesus says like the eye is the lamp of the body, you know, or a house divided cannot fall. All of that stuff, I think, is essentially what Maximus is getting into with like a gnomic will. And I think, and I would argue that it's very true that Jesus, I think it's an error to impose upon Jesus, like even, and Sam and I have talked about this a little bit, it's even like Jesus being tested. Jesus was tested and tempted, because in the New Testament, those words can be just, it's the same word.
Right.
Jesus was not tempted in the way that I am tempted. I don't think that's what the Bible's saying. Jesus was not sitting there deciding like, he wasn't having the kind of experience that I have, like, should I yell at my kids? Should I not? I don't think Jesus ever had that. Like, I think Jesus had a struggle.
He yelled at his disciples.
No, he did. But I don't think, but he never sinned. Like, be angry and do not sin.
And I think so, what he's saying is he never debated, should I yell at my disciples?
Yeah, he just
did it.
The easiest way to say it is he only ever did the will of the Father.
That's what you're saying when he said did not sin. But what are you saying Hebrews says, that sermon in Hebrews that says, you know, he knows us because he knows how we are, you know, how we are tempted and tested. So I see you squaring one side of that, yeah. But I'm curious what you do with the other.
So this is where I don't know exactly how to talk about it, because I do believe, like, these are the verses where Jesus said, like, he was perfected by what he suffered. Mm-hmm. And this is where I think Jesus, in becoming a man, the way that he was tempted and tested was that he endured all the kinds of experiences that we have, but not exactly in the same way. Because he did it without sin. He never did it with a divided eye. His eye was always unified with the will of the Father. Like the garden, the Garden of Gethsemane and the high priestly prayer is just like the most condensed form of this.
Was it potential that Jesus could sin?
I don't think so, no.
See, now we're getting really theological here because, yeah. Well, then the question is, was he fully human?
But I don't think that's what being fully human, this will really derail it. This gets into what I would call the idolatry of libertarian freedom and agency as ultimate. I just don't see that whatsoever. I don't think that you need libertarian freedom to have love. Because I don't think Jesus had that. Because ultimately all my theology comes from God and the Trinity. I don't start with abstracted laws that then I subject the Trinity to.
I got to get this quotation down here because this is going to be a real keeper. Ultimately, I think that all my theology comes from God and the Trinity. Yeah.
Well, I mean, and again,
Luke Thompson.
everything that I'm not saying I'm right about it.
He certainly left his Calvinist roots behind.
Well, I don't know what I think about all that kind of stuff.
I think I heard
you better interpret, Jeff, because this was interesting.
Well, I don't know if I can interpret that. There are some of me. No, but I think I heard in there the question, did Jesus inherit any of the fallen nature of humanity? And I, from how I understand it, I think some of our Catholic folks on the Discord would jump in and say Immaculate Conception and Mary was without sin, right? Maybe I'm misinterpreting what the Catholic understanding of that is, but it's a very interesting question, you know, because when you're talking about did Jesus experience those temptations in the same way, was the ability to sin, was there potential for Jesus to sin? I was having a discussion yesterday about, we were talking about identity and whether or not, and this actually came up on the Discord today, whether or not someone who has not experienced the particulars of someone else's lived experience. So say, for example, I don't know what it's like to live in America as a woman or as a Black person or any particular identity group that you can name that doesn't match my quote-unquote identity group, I have never experienced anything other than my own experience, right? And so am I required to have that particular experience in order to do anything valuable in, or to add any value to a conversation about that particular experience? And so I was having a conversation actually with a theologian about this yesterday, and she was telling me, you know, she asked me, do we need a savior that has experienced all of the particulars in order to be able to save humanity? And so what I gave to her was, I'm not really sure I know the answer to that question, but the first illustration that popped into my mind, being someone who's worked in the business world for a couple of decades now, is, well, first illustration I can think of is a CEO. And in order for a CEO to do a really good job, the CEO doesn't need to be able to come down to an entry-level position and be able to perform that position at the same level as the entry-level person to fully understand all the particulars of what's needed to do that job and to know it, to be able to embody it necessarily. It's almost as if the CEO is able to better serve if the CEO does not is not able to do all of those things as well as that person, because they are able to then better appreciate what that person has to offer in that position. And so, you know, this is of course not a good analogy. This was just an illustration that popped into my mind, you know, but what the CEO needs to be able to do well is to be able to see and connect with that person on such a level where that person feels like they are understood and that they are connected to. And so for me, all of this might tie back to that question of, well, was it possible for Jesus to sin? I think, at least it seems like, even if it were impossible for Jesus to sin, I don't think that that necessarily means that Jesus cannot connect with us and understand what our plight is like.
Well, I think that's really helpful, because the question, of course, haunts, would Jesus need to be a disabled gay woman of color in order to save disabled gay women of color?
Who says he wasn't, Paul?
Well, and this, you know, I remember when I was in Nicaragua in the 80s.
You don't know.
I remember when I was in Nicaragua in the 80s, there is a very interesting church in Nicaragua. You know, this is the height of liberation theology, where you had these murals of Sandinistas hanging naked on the cross. And, you know, where you have in my father's study, there's a picture of Black Jesus hanging on the cross. And this very much gets into this question. But, and I think Luke or Jeff, your observation of the CEO illustration, I think, is a helpful one. I would alter it a little bit, because again, this is why I take notes during these things. The CEO doesn't need to do an entry-level position in order to fully understand, you said. I would say what the CEO needs to do is understand sufficiently. Hmm. And this, I think, gets into this question of temptation. You know, there needs to be, Jesus would need to be sufficiently tempted. Now, the degree to which we can propositionally, accurately, actually suss this out and hold that propositional idea in our brain sufficiently correctly, I mean, that gets terribly theoretical. But what tends to trigger, where this tends to go is, again, C.S. Lewis's essay on, it's really hard to take notes while I'm talking, because otherwise I don't get any notes about what I say, but I wanted to get this in. C.S. Lewis's essay on equality, because how Christ, you know, one of the things I really love about Jonathan Peugeot's work is probably, he's helped me probably more than anyone understand how Christ, because of the hierarchy framework that Jonathan keeps insisting on, something that is very countercultural to, you know, to American egalitarianism. And he shows how Christ fills up the hierarchy from top to bottom. And once you see that, you find it all over the Gospels, where on one hand, and, you know, I've been preaching in 1 Peter, and it's all over the book of 1 Peter, because the New Testament is always playing with these ideas where Christ is, well, he's God. And that's part of my complaint against the Unitarians, because what the Unitarian position finally insists is that he must be a step down from the Father. And of course the Trinitarians monkeyed with this, and whether we're getting them off, you know, on and on and on, put that over there. But Jesus is at the absolute pinnacle of the hierarchy, which is what God means. But then when he tells the disciples that, you know, because they've got the sharp elbows and they want to be the greatest, well, what must you be in order to be the greatest? The servant or the slave, the doulos of Todu, of all. And so there you've got the both ends of the hierarchy, God and the servant of all. So how does Jesus touch the disabled gay woman of color? Well, because in Christ there are, you know, the CEO on a particular hierarchy, the CEO has his status and his role to play. But the entry-level worker also has his or her status and the role to play. And the CEO can't play that entry worker role. And the entry worker can't play the CEO role. And so right there, there's both a hierarchy and an equality. And they both come together at the same time. And that's what C.S. Lewis gets into with his essay on equality, because what Lewis then talks about is the specific pleasure of the inferior. And in our egalitarian ears, that is so offensive. Just the inferior is offensive. But what Lewis illustrates with a couple little illustrations and, you know, draw it into the gospel, and what Jesus illustrates is that there's no, the inferior is not inferior. But you can't lose inferiority, even though you do lose inferiority. And so it seems to violate non-contradiction, but in Christ this happens, so that, you know, Sarah Smith, this quote I read from the Great Divorce in for one of my sermons recently. I mean, talk about a plain name, Sarah Smith from Golders, and somebody, it was great, somebody in England said, yeah, that's a suburb of such and such a place, because of course Lewis used real references, that this common woman who was in some ways the least of these, now in Lewis's heaven becomes the center of glory, to the point that the visitor, you know, well, is this God? Is this Mary? Is this, you know? No, this is a woman that lived in a small place and perhaps made her living scrubbing floors for wealthier people. But now she's celebrated. And so what you find in Christ is that all of this is built into Christ. And so the specific pleasure of the inferior becomes glorious, just like the glory of the CEO, but there's place for both.
I think it was in Lewis's membership essay where he talked about something similar to this. It may have been in the membership essay where he was talking about how he had two points, and they both, one led to the other, where he was talking about the necessity of egalitarianism in politics.
Yep.
Because of the evil that is in people.
Equality is good medicine, but not good food. That's his quote.
That was his quote. But then he also talked about how the church is a place that encourages us to remember what eating the food is like, because there are stations, there are positions which receive honor, and then there are also stations which supplicate, right? And that it's built, a need is built into us to be able to supplicate to something worthy of supplication. And that's what these rituals in church, where you have a priest, and when you prostrate yourself and you venerate, you know, either icons or also the, I don't understand this well at all, because I've been to Father, I've been to Father David's church one time, and it's as if the priest is like a physical representation, or manifestation is the wrong word, but like a symbol of Christ, right? And so there's a lot of honor that is given in those circles, and so, you know, this just connected for me with Lewis of how it is right and good to show honor to those things that are higher than us, because even in showing that honor, we are becoming more truly human and more ourselves. Lewis does it much better than I do, but that's kind of the gist of what I was getting from it.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And so, again, back to the like stories of old. I mean, it was really good. In the second of the videos, he notes Peugeot's, I think, really excellent observation when Peugeot treated it when the Wonder Woman movie came out, that what our culture has done is cast women in masculine roles. And what that creates then is the only kind of glorious power we recognize is masculine. And so even what's that?
It's anti-feminist.
Right. So even in the attempt to banish a supremacy of the of male over female, an attempt to banish the patriarchy, what you wind up doing is, we don't have a word for it, the masculinarchy. That what you do is you instantiate the masculinarchy in an attempt to banish the patriarchy, because now the masculine is the only power that has supremacy. And well, now we get back to instantiation and actuality. Well, who's going to win that game 9 times out of 10 in the Aristotelian world of real people and things? Guess what? It's people with testosterone pumping through their bodies. Okay, so let's pump testosterone through bodies with XX chromosomes. Well, what happens? Well, they develop higher rates of cancer, and you scotch their capacity to produce children, and so, you know, suddenly we wind up with this bizarro world where, you know, and again, now we're back into Peugeot's clown world, where the fringe tries to take over the center, and the center, in order to establish some kind of moral hierarchy, pretends to go to the fringe, but doesn't really.
In its most extreme form, almost, this is, I think, the fruit of the original point of proposition as potential versus reality, is that what is my idea about my identity, I am a woman, is more real than the fact that I have a penis, you know? Or like,
yeah, I just got so many hot takes from Luke this video. I am a woman, the fact that I have a penis.
Hot take, I have a penis.
Really. We believe you. Okay. We believe you.
but I mean, I don't think that's, I guess that's the thing that I want Christians to realize, I think, is that
you want Christians to realize a propositional truth.
No, that I
you
want
them
to
realize it more, but the only way you can convey it to them is a proposition. I mean, and that's the trick of this thing. Is that even in an attempt to...
I'm trying to illustrate a spirit.
What's that?
I'm trying to like test and discern a spirit. I don't want to just label it. I want to say this is the recurrent pattern. And this is the thing. Yeah, and I can only tell you that propositionally. Yes.
Right.
Absolutely. But like, this is the recurrent pattern that we're seeing. And this phenomenon with transgenderism is downstream of this reality. That's the manifestation. I'm trying to talk about the spirit, which is fine, and I can only convey, I'm not against propositions, but I'm trying to say, like, if you want to treat that in a way that isn't just like excluding bad, wrong, dualistic, you guys are bad people culture wars, if you want to actually treat that spirit, then we need to go back and realize what propositions are and take the log out of our eye. That's what I'm trying to say.
Well, and again, this illustration of the, when we use the third person and the second person and the first person, lends power to the power of witness, because witness is the first person. witness is I can't label you. I can't misgender you, or maybe I won't misgender you or label you, and I won't even do so by insinuation by declaring the propositional that a woman plus testosterone plus surgery equals a man. I won't even play in the propositional realm. What is the power? It is the power of witness. And so when I see the stereotypical straight white male bending over backwards publicly acknowledging their privilege, but you know, not becoming the not living as the disabled gay woman of color, there's a lack of witness in that. There's a lack of witness and a falsity in that acknowledgement of privilege that endures no matter how much racism coaching they get. And so what you begin to see then is, then again, both why this comes out of Christianity and how Christianity actually anticipates and manages these issues. And so again, I've been preaching through the book of 1 Peter, and you know, one of the delights of being a pastor who also makes videos is that on one hand, I've got this video stream going where I'm working through these ideas and talking with you guys. On the other hand, I'm working these biblical books. And so right there in 1 Peter, at the end of chapter 2 and the beginning of chapter 3, there are these terribly offensive passages where Peter says to slaves, obey your masters as you would the Lord, even the unjust ones. And we look at that and we recoil. No, the path of redemption is revolution. And then it goes further because, you know, we don't have a lot of people that we label as slaves around. Women, submit to your husbands. And that, you know, well, now it's really on. And no, it's the path of revolution of self-assertion. And now obviously, you know, Romans 13 is you have to, your Bible both has Romans 13 and these passages, as well as Acts 3 and 4. And, Paul and Jesus play very interesting games with respect to obeying authority. Jesus does not always obey the religious authorities. Jesus does not always obey the Roman authorities. And you see that worked through in Christ's story. But the alarming assertion of the gospel is that God became, Philippians 2, God became a slave in Jesus Christ. And in this way, in Christ, the universe is filled, even if in the age of decay, you are a disabled gay woman of color or a sex slave in a Vietnamese brothel or a Haitian cane cutter, or a grunt in some call center in suburban Dallas making minimum wage. And so now suddenly there's hope, not just for the heroes of the world, but for the slaves. And that all comes together. And so you will be my witnesses is a story of, well, you know, you're gonna talk a lot and not be understood, and you're going to be abused for it, and they're going to take your life. But I'll raise you. I'm not so sure about the resurrection thing. Well, then the rest of the story doesn't make much sense either. I'm sorry. You got me preaching. I'll shut up.
Oh, that's good.
Go ahead, Jeff.
I think we could talk for a really long time, but I actually have to run. So no need for you guys to stop, but I have to dip out.
Well, let's not break up the trilogy. I'm fake preaching in order to real preach a little later on this week. But thank you both. Any last things you want to put in there? Plug for the Randos channel.
always.
For the Randos channel is, you know, feel free to send content, because that's what it's all about. It's not about one person. It's about a group of us just having these conversations and trying to get places that we couldn't get without each other. So there's the plug for the Randos channel. You are the content creator.
I think it's the essence of YouTube, frankly. I think it's what YouTube ought to be. So
Randos?
That's great. Randos. Randos United. All right. Thank you, gents.
Okay. Thank you, Paul.
Oh, stop recording for just a second. I do need to stick around for one thing.
Sorry. Okay. I'll stop recording. Oh.